Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
This is the background song in that.
Some said never, but they never done come.
In that Pepsi commercial that the world is talking about, but not able to see now, Pepsi's pulled the ad because of all of the heat they were taking. Kendall Jenner is the one that crosses the line of protesters and sort of bridges the Black Lives Matter people with the cop. And what she does is hands him a soda, and then everybody cheers. And some people think that's sort of belittling the whole backdrop of that conversation. Yeah, they're selling soda. I can see it both ways. What do you need? We'll talk about that after 2:30 here on WGN. I wonder what Amy Dickinson would think about that, the Ask Amy columnist. How
I
are
will
you?
Tell you. Yeah, I'm yes. great.
Yes.
I'm great.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We're here to talk about your book, but talk to me about that ad. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have seen the ad.
What's your reaction to that?
My reaction to the ad was a lot like other people's, in that you have this media celebrity who has... You know, doesn't have like a real job. I know she works hard, but and she wasn't broaching the Black Lives. She's appropriating it.
Yeah.
And I saw somebody on social media posted a photo of a police officer pushing up against Martin Luther King. So you contrast the Pepsi ad with the real world.
What it was really like.
What it was really like. I have to say, though, as a media person, I do think Pepsi did the perfect, you know, they responded to this perfectly. They pulled the ad and they have issued a statement that I think is completely appropriate.
What like, did it say? I haven't seen the reaction.
It said, you know, we were trying to do something. It has obviously failed in a huge way. We have pulled the ad. We apologize. We also apologize for putting Kendall Jenner in this position.
Hmm. Boy, only if our president would once in a while offer out words like this. I'm completely transitioning to a different topic now, but every now and then
I'll go there with you, my friend.
Every now and then you try your best. Every now and then the words fail you, or even your logic fails, and then you say, "Yeah, we screwed up. We're playing on a big stage, and we're big enough that we can accept that and move on."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wouldn't that do a world of good for this country if our leader would say that?
Yeah. Yes. Instead of doubling down. Over and over and over again. And, you know, I know we'll talk about my book, but I am here on a media tour and a book tour and visiting bookstores in different cities. And I will say I had an opportunity to go on the Bill O'Reilly show last month when my book first came out. And I've been on the show before. And after thinking about it for about 5 seconds, I said, I cannot accept this.
Because of the recent allegations against
him? No, not because of the recent allegations. Because of all of the allegations. This is not new.
Are we talking about Bill O'Reilly or Donald Trump here?
Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I just segued because Donald Trump just, you know, decided to spend part of his day defending Bill O'Reilly. And that's indefensible. It's completely indefensible.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say is segueing back to the Pepsi, the advertisers are pulling... from Bill O'Reilly, but it's not just advertisers. There are people who won't be on a show.
Advertisers, yeah, advertisers as well, but I haven't heard of many guests making that decision.
But I mean, look, Bill O'Reilly could care less whether or not I'm on his show. It was a real opportunity for me, but what I'm trying to say is this. There comes a point where his brand, so to speak, based on his behavior, which is real, his brand is so bad that I don't want it to touch me, you know? Not to mention I don't want to be in a room alone with him. And I mean that. No, I mean that because
that sounds...
I've been in the studio with him.
And what's his personal behavior like in
You know, it's funny.
Like
years and years ago when I first did the show, I've described this to many people as one of the strangest experiences in my life. It's a large studio with a round desk at the time. And it was set up sort of like a Charlie Rose thing, although not, there was no warmth. It was very cold, and the entire studio was dark except this pin spot over the desk. And what I remember so vividly was that he never made eye contact with me. Mm. And I mean, he might have like a social disorder or Asperger's or whatever, but it was so noticeable. It was like a refusal to connect with me. And it was very, very strange. When the segment was over, he didn't thank me. And it went very well. I mean, he was pugilistic and I punched back. You know, it was great.
No, you're a good interview.
We were laughing. When it was over, he cast his eyes down and he never said thank you or goodbye. And a producer sort of tiptoed in and led me away. Never had an experience like that.
Wow.
Ever.
So what's the read on that? Does he have psychological issues? Has he got women issues? Is he can't be so intimate as actually looking a woman in the eye as he's talking to her?
I thought that it had to do, at the time, and this was 8-9 years ago, maybe more, I thought that it had to do with just a basic inability to connect with someone. I think it's probably pretty common with other people who have met him. I also, even at the time, he had woman trouble at the time. A producer of his had just made he had just settled a case with a producer.
The number's staggering, isn't
it? Yeah,
the number
totally.
Is staggering.
And even at the time, I remember thinking, he is not interested, in quotes, in me. I'm roughly his age. I have nothing of interest to Bill O'Reilly. You know, I'm little, I'm brown-haired, you know, I got nothing for this guy. I don't agree with him.
Yeah, really. Well, I mean, clearly you don't agree with them, but I always thought that makes for good conversation,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
If you all are respectful, let's stop talking about Bill O'Reilly and talk about your books. So The Mighty Queens of Freeville was a biography written by you.
Well, it's a memoir.
It's a memoir.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Steve and I were kidding. Most of us would be happy if we lived a life so interesting that one book would contain it, but no, you have two books about you by you.
And you know the irony is that...
And you're not an egotist at all, so I thought, now how do you justify that, Amy?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, the irony and like the big inside joke about both books, and really the point of these books, is that I have not led a fascinating life. I have not. My life has been completely average. And by average, I say it has been full of drama, personal drama. It has been full of heartbreak, pain, loss, grief, love, laughing, all of it. And so, honestly, with this book, what I chose to do and really what I feel when I see it and when I talk about it is it's about opening up my life to my readers and to the people who write to me with their problems. And I'm not saying, oh, your problems are little. Look at me. You know, what I'm saying is, I get it. Look at me.
Well, the title of the second book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things, which is, of course, your sort of occupation, but maybe it's also your disposition. I wonder if you were not doing what you do, is there something about your personality or your persona that lends itself to people doing that sort of thing?
I think there is. Honestly, I think I look open.
Because Bill O'Reilly was talking to me, and he said that he's got nothing to say to you. He said he's nothing there.
He is in love with me. No, I missed a flight recently. I'm on this Whirlwind book tour, and I actually, at the time when you can least afford to do it, I missed a flight because somebody had engaged me in conversation. And honestly, it was my responsibility. I was so interested in what she was saying.
Really?
That I missed my flight.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, that's good for you that you can be that kind of a person. That's a very generous person that gives their attention when they know full well they've got a flight around the corner. You write about your second husband, who is somebody that you knew at the age of 10 or 12, right?
Yeah. Bruno and I first met. I grew up on a farm in this tiny village in upstate New York. And Bruno and I went to high school together. His family farmed about 3 miles away. And, yeah, I've known him my whole life.
On and off, or had you stayed in?
No, you know, I knew him in childhood. And then here's where this is kind of an Ask Amy situation. I knew him in childhood. He stayed home. I left. He became a builder, a contractor, a home builder, a business owner. And I moved back to my hometown to do what 4 in 10 Americans are doing, which is taking care of a family member. And I moved back home to do that. And I needed to renovate my mom's house a little bit because she was disabled. So I called old Bruno, who I had gone to high school with, who, you know, is a really good builder. And it was like falling into the cheesiest Hallmark Channel movie.
Did you have a little bit of an agenda when you called him? You could have called anybody.
I did. I had caught glimpses of Bruno over the years. And I talk about this in my book. and that zing, you know, zing, zing. Yeah, I definitely had the zing, zing. But I wasn't really aware of his situation.
How old were his situation, meaning...
He had been divorced for about 5 years.
Was he single? Was he eligible? Whatever.
Right. I wasn't quite aware if he was eligible. And once I learned that he was eligible, I called him.
Then you said, maybe could you do my other bathroom? Could you mow the lawn?
He actually declined to do this renovation. And I remember calling my best friend afterwards and saying, like, oh, my God, I would pay this guy just to come to my house and have coffee with me.
He was, the electricity was there at least on your end, right?
Definitely,
off the bat.
Yeah.
He's a really good looking guy, isn't he?
He's a doll.
Did you ask him to mow the lawn with his shirt off like they did?
It did have that quality. Yeah, he's this burly guy. Yeah.
Had you had that sort of a passion for somebody prior to that? Had it been a while since you sort of found that sort of love welling up in you? And was that very exciting when it happens?
John, I gotta tell you, I'm almost 60 years old, and your virginity does grow back, it turns out.
Isn't it nice to know that you can feel that again?
Yes, it had been a million years. I was single for almost 18 years, and I had not dated very much. And I really felt like this is it for me. I am going to be living with my mom, you know, the spinster forever. And this really, the good thing is this, I did sort of internet dating. I tried this and that over the years. And I felt like it had polished me up for the show. You know, when this man walked onto my porch, I was like, oh, I'm ready.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
How I wish that for people in your circumstance. I don't think so many people are so lucky to have that moment.
I know. It was
amazing.
Pretty great. Huh. And you know what? Times since our meeting and marriage have been tough. And there are times, I think any married couple, there are some times when all you've got is that wonderful zing zing memory of when you met, you know?
I didn't know the thing about matches and burning things with you.
Oh, I know.
I want to talk about that in just a second. Amy Dickinson's second book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. Previously, you read her The Mighty Queens of Freeville. If you didn't, you should. You can certainly read her in newspapers. All right, we got a couple minutes left with our guest. Her name is Amy Dickinson. Her latest book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. You may read the Ask Amy advice columns that she authors. And then writes books, and then travels, and then has this ordinary life. Evidently, I think it's extraordinary, but I guess when you write as well as you do. You know what? I want you to write my autobiography.
Oh, I would love to.
I don't have that much to say. I grew up in the suburbs. I will never be a jazz musician. I don't have enough pain or suffering in my life. But I'll bet you could even make somebody like me seem interesting. What was the predilection with you and matches as a child?
When I was a kid, you know, part of my story is sort of growing up in poverty. And I'm going to segue to I would eat matches when I was a kid. And I was taken to the doctor. And I think I had pica, which is this sort of it's a form of malnutrition, not because of poverty, but just because I had it. And I was craving the sulfur. So anyway, I ate matches. Until I was told to stop, and then I did. And then later in my story, I talk about burning some of my mother's possessions in my yard. This is, I know, a challenging concept for some people, but I live in the country, and people burn stuff, you know? And I faced this after my mother's death, which really, really emptied me out emotionally. I faced this issue of what to do with not her things, but a house and a barn full of not hoarder stuff, but like furniture. And I mean, my family has lived in the same spot for 200 years.
A life of stuff, yeah.
A life of beautiful stuff and broken stuff and in-between stuff. And this is an issue that people in my age group are dealing with. We're trying to downsize ourselves, and then we land with households full of stuff. And one of the things I decided to do was to burn. I sold things. I gave things away. I mean, I dispensed with things in a respectful way, but there were things that were broken, things that carried this emotional weight for me, and I decided to burn them. And I feel like that was like the best thing I could have done.
And not to destroy them or get rid of them, but literally burning
them. Burn them. Burning.
To destroy them right before your eyes with your own hand was cathartic somehow?
It was. I just felt so burdened by these possessions, losing them in that way, watching them go up in smoke. I felt free. And I felt more able to cope with the rest, all of the other aspects of grief and loss.
You know, my friend Thomas Jefferson burned all of his wife's letters, those great letters that they had back and forth. He said, "Well, I can't have that."
I would never burn a document or a letter, but I will definitely burn a broken plant stand. You know, definitely.
That's less dramatic. The book is terrific, and you always are too. Why aren't you doing what I do? I mean, I know you're on the radio, but do you have any desire to do a talk show on WGN Radio someday?
I would love to. I would love to. I would have to live here to do it,
yeah.
Probably.
Well, maybe not, but shut my mouth. I just got here, so I don't need you horning in on anybody's job, but it's always a pleasure to read and see you.
Thank you, John. I feel exactly the same way.
Get the book Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. It's 1:50, almost 8 on WGN.